G'day folks, talk to Jordan Steele John about all things Royal Commission into the violence, abuse, neglect and exploitation of people with disability. The submission of the final report, the 222 recommendations, where we jump into the future of group homes, SILs, education, employment, incarceration, First Nations, call groups, accessibility, decision-making, advocacy, healthcare and treatment, the NDIS, Quality and Safeguards Commission. Taking a lot of this information to put it out there and seeing if we can get laws to change, policies for a more inclusive disability Australia. Keep levelling up the playing fields. We have a voice and we're bloody using it. And off the back of these recommendations, I hope to see some solid change in all states and territories. And general service provision, what is that going to look like? Because we need accountability in the community. There's so many vulnerable individuals out there, millions. And every day, people are born or acquire disabilities. So that number's going to keep trickling up. So the community, the government, federal and state, and lawmakers need to come together to stamp some of this stuff out for positive change. So many lives are affected. And where we need to get out under the shadow of health, disability is its own sector. Solid yarn. And the way that he puts it in his words of how he should see fit from the political platform. So let's see in the next coming months, years, how that documentation can ripple through the environment and make change. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe or follow button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to roll with the squad and become a patron, that'd be great. And I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Senator Jordan Steele John, welcome back, my friend.
Great to be back with you, Jake.
Mate, well, let's just jump straight in today. 222 recommendations into the Royal Commission into violence, abuse, neglect, and exploitation of people with disability. Big news for the nation. A lot of ripple effects going on here. So how does the final report make you feel as someone with disability and also the position that you're in today?
I think there's a number of emotions, Jake. First one is pride. I feel a deep sense of pride in our disability community, in everyone that campaigned so long and hard for the establishment of the investigation, of everyone that gave evidence to the investigation of their own lived experience and their expertise. And I think that we together produced a report which speaks to the scale of the discrimination that we experience and the harm that we are subjected to, often in the very systems that were set up supposedly to support us, to enable us. So there's pride there. There's also a deep sense of determination. What we have in the report is an opportunity now to take the steps that we know as a disability community are needed to be taken to end the cycle of segregation, of isolation and of abuse, which has so harmfully impacted so many of us. So we have an opportunity now to take those actions, those tangible actions needed to end segregated schooling, to end segregated work, and to end segregated housing, particularly. And it's action that I'm now looking to the government to take. We've done our bit as disabled people. Now it is time for the federal government and the state governments to do theirs. And I'm determined to continue to push for that as part of the broader disability justice movement.
Solid words. Righto, 18% of Australians have got some sort of form of disability, whether that's physical or invisible, right? So,
yep.
And when you're looking at Royal Commissions and the history of them, and where some have got a bit of teeth in them and some don't, but in respect to the hard work that's been put in from the community, from the commissions, from people like yourself, do you think it's got enough teeth to really gain what's in the recommendations to really make a solid bloody difference?
I think we've got enough teeth, Jake. I think there are 4.4 million disabled people who are done with being chained to our beds, who are done with being locked in our rooms, who are done with being separated in class, who are done with being subjected to ableism and segregation by government policy and design. We are done with it. And we now demand our government join with us in the work of transforming those systems so that they are inclusive and uphold our rights without exception. And that is the work we're now determined to do. We will not allow this report to gather dust on a shelf inside the bureaucracy. We will continue to work together to get these recommendations implemented and this change enacted. So, in short, we are the teeth, my friend, and we intend to bite and be bolshy until this change is done.
I'm with you there. You know, I'll be wheeling forward with the teeth pronged out, that's for sure. So, and one of the, when you're looking at the wording, right, and there's a lot of powerful stuff in there and just the way that the report's put together are recommendations, but also I'm just so glad that, you know, because I get sick of it, disability seen as a deficit, right, especially when it's got to do within that medical model. Yeah.
Yep.
And that's what needs to get driven home. And that's from the top down. That's coming from, if you're looking at the different state and federal, mainly when you're looking at state and territories, right, also federal, but when you're looking at the health ministers and where that's going to trickle down to the health professionals and the information and education that has to come from your clinical professionals, yeah?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I 100% agree with you. I think that what is really important to recognize is that so much of the report speaks to the reality that the barriers and discrimination we experience as disabled people is a function of the ableist policies or structures in society rather than a function of our impairment or difference. So the brokenness is not with us. We are not broken. We are not lesser. The barrier is in society, and together with our allies in the community, we can bring those barriers down and rebuild inclusive policies and structures, and that's what we need to do. And government needs to get on board with that. And government needs to be conscious of what the social model of disability is and what it means to understand that the barriers exist in the society and not with the individual, and need to get to work with us to do that. And there needs to be a sense of urgency. There needs to be a sense of ambition. There needs to be a problem-solving mindset. It is not good enough to say that the realization of our rights is just a bit too hard and complicated and big to be dealt with right now. We are not big and hard and complicated. We are human beings, and we assert in this moment our right to have our basic human rights up.
Yeah, and when you're looking at also what's really, really important, like you've always heard when it's got to do, whether that's from the agency or the disability sector, when it's got to do with co-design, 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 and where I want you to speak to, which is great, that's within the report, is co-production and what that means. Because, you know, because what I see a lot, and this is people, whether they're getting involved with the government, whether they're getting involved with private entities, because I see a lot of people with disability where they've got their IP, their intellectual property, and where I don't want to see it where it's just where they give that, and then you've got consultants or other people that just take that IP and run with it and want to design and produce it for themselves. It's where co-production, where it's from the start to the bloody finish line. So can you talk to us about co-production and what that means to our mob out there with disability?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's two elements that are so important here. One is power sharing, right? Power sharing as a fundamental baseline starting point for the co-creative process. So that means bringing disabled people in on the ground level, but it also means working with disabled people to understand what the ground level is. You know, if you're bringing somebody on once you've decided what you want to implement, you're not co-designing. You are consulting on implementation, not co-designing direction. And there's a key difference there. And then as we collaborate on the production of the project, the advancement, you know, once we've decided what we're doing and we're working towards implementation, there has to be co-production along all elements of the timeline in order to get ultimately to achieve the object that you've set out to achieve. So, yes, we need co-production. Co-production is, in my mind, the result of power sharing. And power sharing needs to be something that government needs to get better at because it hates it. Government hates power sharing. It doesn't even particularly like consultation. So we've got to, again, assert you are not going to get outcomes that are either what we need or that we will accept as a community unless those outcomes are the product of co-design.
That's it. And it's just knocking on the head, just the ableism and just those viewpoints, whether that's in the public and the private sector, we just need to keep hammering that home. There's plenty of people with disability that are more than capable, you know, whether that's if they're doing it from home or getting out to meetings where they can co-design, but co-produce, power share and getting it done. And all that's doing, it's closing the gap on certain facets within our realm of disability.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we need to be doing that in the implementation of these recommendations, right? Like there is an urgent need to take up the very clear recommendations that were made by the disabled commissioners to end segregated education, segregated work, and segregated housing. That needs to be the goal of the government. Now, the way in which we do that needs to be co-designed with disabled people, and it needs to be urgent in the work. There needs to be a well-managed transition that involves disabled people and parents and school administrators and service provision experts and academics. And this needs to be a collaborative co-design and co-produce process with an end point which reflects the reality of the harm that these segregated, isolated settings do to people. It is not acceptable to ask us to wait another decade before we remove the caveat on the minimum wage in Australia, which says it's the minimum wage for everyone except disabled people. It's not acceptable for us to wait until 2051 for us to remove the caveat on the education system, which currently says we have an education system for everyone except for disabled people. And it is not okay for us to wait another decade before we remove the caveat on the housing system, which says if you're a disabled person, not only will you be subject to the extortionate rents and the extortionate prices and the suffering of the growth of interest rate payments and all of those things, you will also be housed in a setting where you don't get to choose who you live with and what you do in your home. That's not acceptable. So we need to have a co-designed, co-produced solutions, and they need to be delivered along a timeline that reflects the reality that these situations cannot be allowed to continue to exist for decades. That's right.
Before
into the
we get into some of those caveats and align with some of those really important ones when it's got to do with employment, education, housing. So how does that look? How would that look in regards to if you've got those three or just all the topics in general off the back of the recommendations? How does it look if it's formulated across the nation or in different states, if it's having groups of identified disability power brokers that are really experienced in their field of choice? Like when it's got to do with, look, I'm almost thinking like if this is what they propose, like The Voice, right? You know, but say if it was that model, but different. So if it is like groups of individuals that are at the top of their game, yes, they have a disability, they've got lived experience, and who are they working with? What would that look like if it was like something similar what's proposed for what's getting voted in tomorrow, or if it's another sort of model? So what does that look like on, because that's only going to scale up and make a difference, I reckon.
So I think there's two actions that need to be taken. One is that, and this was a recommendation of the Royal Commission, right? So there needs to be established a disability minister within the cabinet, and there needs to be established a Department of Disability within government. And in my view, that department would take in within itself the disability functions, obviously, of the NDIA and the running of the NDIS, but it would also remove from the Department of Social Services the administration of things like the DSP and the carers allowance and all the various different social services elements related to disability. We take ownership of the National Disability Strategy implementation, and it would also reach across into the Attorney General's Department and bring within itself the relevant entities around the Disability Discrimination Act and the enforcement and modification of Australian law in relation to disability discrimination. It would then also take elements of education and employment to bring within its remit what we need to do in the education and employment spaces. So you would have one minister leading a department which reaches across all of the areas in which we need to implement these recommendations and works in a cohesive, structured way towards those policy end goals. That would enable the disability community to have one contact point and one person to hold accountable for how we are progressing towards those goals. And then in terms of, so that's part one, if you like, and that's actually not that much of a proposal, right? We've got a First Nations minister, we've got a women's minister, like there should be a disability minister, and that disability minister should be a disabled person, and that department should be founded on the principles of and have a deep understanding of the social and affirmative model, the model of disability, and what are our nation's obligations under the CRPD. So that's the government structural change that I think is neat, as well as, you know, implementation of our obligations under the CRPD within Australian domestic law. So that's your structural changes. The other piece of what do we as a community need to do?
This is important.
And I think that what we need to do as a community is continue to develop our political and cultural capacity, because I believe that we will get the change we want to see when there is a combination of a strong, politically engaged, culturally confident disability community, which is then able to apply lobbying power and political pressure to the political institution itself, and that is a that's a kind of grassroots community effort. So we need to continue to organise and connect, and kind of liberate ourselves from the internalised ableism that we often have within ourselves as well. And I think there's some wonderful examples of that. I mean, everybody knows there's basically a national conference circuit around International Day of Disability and all those kind of things, but we're also seeing the growth of disability pride festivals and ever more presence of disabled people in the arts. So we need to continue to grow that, grow the disability community, in order to apply pressure to those government and procedural mechanisms. And we need to be absolutely unafraid of being bolshy.
That's right. And I'll bring you, and I'm glad that you bring in the cultural element too, because it's so, when you're talking about intersectionality, there's a lot going on. Like when you're talking about if it's First Nations, if it's coal groups, if it's got to do with gender identified, there's so much going on. And when it's got to do with disability on top, multi-layered. Yeah. And it's, you know, and when you got the grassroots, putting that on full broadcast, so at the end of the day, and I'm glad you went off the back of the recommendations, because if you are looking at the top of the tier, the tip of the spear, which would be that disability minister, and it would be great, and from my perspective too, that they should have lived experience of disability, right? And that's where it's straying away, peeling off from the medical side of things. It's running on its own steam. And because you're looking at the NDIS, you're looking at the capacity of it, what it's going to blow out to be, and it's going to continuously grow. Like everybody is going to either be born or acquire disabilities every day, you know?
Yeah. And we do need to, as we make that argument, Jake, for greater government engagement, I think we need to be willing to push back, and I'm a little bit concerned about this, about the idea that the NDIS should be, you know, significantly dismantled in favour of, you know, mainstreaming disability. And, you know, we need this to be foundational, you know, this language of foundational supports. Because here's the rub. We absolutely do need to have inclusion in every part of government, right? But the people that are making, let's just be honest about this, the people that are making the argument for foundational supports are not making the argument because they're woken up one day and go, oh, do you know what? Every service really should be accessible to disabled people. They're making the argument because they've been given a direction to cut the cost of the NDIS by a certain percentage point by a certain year. That's the goal of the Treasury. 8%, capping the scheme at 8% and saving the government $59 billion in the process. And if that is your starting point, then really what you will end up doing is sugarcoating a process of kicking disabled people off the supports we currently have, like throwing to them to the wind of the states and going, well, you know what, it's good, thank you very much, but there'll be foundational supports when you land. When they don't exist.
That's right.
Currently, and they will take years to build properly. You know, so we've got to be conscious that that is a bit of a word game that's happening now, and it's not an either or. You know, it's not, you know, you can actually do both.
Yeah, because that's just going cart before the horse. And, you know, if you're going to throw it back on the states and territories, and if there's no structure back there, you know, try and cut it 8%. Come on. So.
Well, what are you going to say to an autistic, you know, what are you going to say to an autistic kid that needs supports, need adaptations? Oh, sorry, you're costing the scheme too much. We've got to kick you off now, but don't worry, in a couple of years, your state or territory will develop a foundational support, which will look completely different than what another state or territory would develop, so you best not never want to move. You know, that's the system we had before, mate. And we are not going back to that system. And I don't, you know, it is immaterial whether our refusal to go back to that system is inconvenient. You know, that doesn't factor into my consideration. Our rights are not contingent on whether the achievement of them are particularly convenient to any particular politician at a certain point in time.
Yeah. So, hey, our last discussion, and it was a heated hot topic when you're talking about ADEs, Australian Disability Enterprises. And there's big words, and this does carry through with group homes as such, but if you're going back and blanking this over ADEs, out. But that's a process. Yep. But in the meantime, when you're talking about putting dollars in people's pockets where they should belong, take us through it, Jordan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So I think we need to ground ourselves really firmly in this conversation in an understanding that there is, in Australia, a cycle of segregation. And we've just got to call it by its name. It's not a cycle of special. It's not a cycle of supported, it's a cycle of segregation. And that cycle of segregation begins in school, where people are segregated and isolated. And it continues through to segregated housing and segregated work, where in those settings, people are abused, they are neglected, they are exploited in the workplace, you know, pay dollars on the hour compared to somebody else. And that cycle of segregation and their existence in those settings leads to abuse and early death. That is what the Royal Commission found, and that is what we have lived as disabled people. And so when we then look at, you know, what do we now do, I hold in my head, and the government needs to hold in its collective head, the reality that we are ending these settings because of those reasons, you know? So what do we then do? What does it look like to achieve that? Because it is an important goal. In education, what that looks like is you need all of them, actually, you need a national strategy for the elimination of segregation.
And it all starts in education when kids are at school, you know? But also...
Absolutely. Of course it does. Of course it does. And I think it's reasonable to want to achieve all three of those goals in the next 7 to 10 years. You know, that's the timeline that we need to be working along. It needs to begin with a fully co-created strategy, bringing in disabled people, parents, school administrators, academic experts, and members of the government to decide how we're going to do this. It needs to look at what are the underlying drivers here. So for education, why is it that people end up in education? Overwhelmingly, people end up in segregated education because of the phenomena of gatekeeping. They're pushed out of 100%. Their public schools into segregated settings. They are told that there is no way to provide their students with supports in a mainstream setting when that is not true. They end up in those settings because of a chronically under-resourced public school system, and we do need to correct that. And as we do that, we need to offer teachers, school administrators, the additional tools and resources to be able to teach to the whole of their class. So that looks like modifying the curriculum and those kind of things. And then there's the brass tacks basics of, you know, infrastructure modification in our public school and private school system. So all of those things need to be done, and then we will be able to realise a truly inclusive education system. A truly inclusive education system that works not only much better for disabled students, it just works better for everyone, man.
100%.
Like 40 to 40% of kids in class are divergent of one form or another. Our public system and our school curriculum is failing kids, failing teachers, and leaving both really burnt and really tired. So it is time to transform the whole thing anyway, quite frankly. Fund it a hell of a lot better, support people a hell of a lot better. My proposition is that inclusion be the goal of that transformation. So that's how you deal with segregated ed. In terms of, and a lot of people I know have expressed concern of, well, there are certain supports that my child receives in a segregated school. That we're worried that they wouldn't receive those supports in the mainstream system. Well, that's the point of increasing resources so that they could be, but also redirecting resources so that they are. Because we do actually spend a lot of money on disabled education in Australia. We just spend it in a way that reinforces rather than deconstructs segregation. So we've got to realign policy settings. Then in work, my friend, there cannot be a caveat on the minimum wage.
No, not at all.
That says if you're disabled, $2 an hour. Now, there's a few arguments that are rolled out about the interaction with the disability support pension and what would that mean. And my response to that is twofold. One is we can easily change those requirements and settings so that you earn more before the DSP is reduced. I would also say that if you are simply placing somebody in a program that kind of simulates, it doesn't simulate work because we give our labor to a program which calls itself a workshop. But it is not an employment setting experienced by anybody else in the Australian workforce. So what we need to see is modify the DSP settings, absolutely bust the discrimination that exists in the workforce where it comes to making an application. You're good and then you don't get the job. There needs to be an acknowledgement that actually if you're not earning more than the DSP because of the policy settings, like, do you want to be doing what you're doing? Like, do you want to be doing with your day what you're doing at the ADE? Or would you like to be doing something else since it's not actually earning you any more money than if you just had the DSP? So what are the other options for helping people expend their energies and time in a meaningful way? And these things are deeply connected with education
along the way
because of the low rate.
They do it for able-bodied people, Jesus.
Absolutely, but the low rate of completion of year 12 and the differentiated curriculum to which disabled people are taught in segregated educational settings is a huge barrier to then gaining employment or moving on to higher education after school. So, again, I think we can achieve that transition in 7 years. The reality is that the trajectory of the segregated work providers is declining because the NDIS can't see the point in paying a private provider to then underpay a disabled, which, to be fair, is one of the most rational decisions I've ever seen the NDIS
slavery
make, to be honest. Well, it is discrimination. It's unacceptable. It's currently sanctioned by Australian law and shouldn't be sanctioned by Australian law. And then finally, there's housing. And we know disabled people, that you have every
and can I just say too, and that's with the housing too, and like when you're trying to, because that's the biggest pushback from, and it's hard to get over the line for individuals when it's got to do with the NDIS, right, or there's other schemes as well, but it's not a It's not an answer to homelessness. It's not an answer to homelessness. Well, where do you want these individuals to go? They're going to end up out on the streets. Like, then what?
Yeah. So again, that we've got to recognise with housing, the situation at the moment is untenable. It is not acceptable to continue to house disabled people in this way. It leads to isolation, abuse, early death, all of these things that the Royal Commission has found. So what do we need to do? We need to recognise that disabled people face every barrier that every other person in Australia faces to housing, extraordinarily high rent, extraordinarily stagnant or low wages, challenges around the increases of interest rates in terms of what mortgage repayments cost, all of those things, plus some additional factors that you're overwhelmingly likely to come up to a situation where your house is physically inaccessible to you because of the way in which they've been built. If you need public housing, not only are you sitting on a list years long with everybody else, but again, a tiny proportion of public housing stock is physically accessible to you. So we need to solve those problems through changes to code and investments in redevelopment of that.
Change the code, that's a big one.
Usually, we need to make sure that the SIL, the SDA require the specialist disability housing accommodation requirements in the NDIS, you to live with your carers and partners in the context that you wish to live independently. And then we need to support people currently in those settings to transition out of them. Because we do need to acknowledge that if you have lived in one of these institutions for 20, 30 years, there needs to be a really well-managed process of what they call deinstitutionalization.
That's it, and it's not going to a mini-institution. So it's going to a more independent living situation, not just going from big scale to small scale and it's the same. No.
Well, people, whenever you have this conversation, and like I've done a lot of work in this area, particularly around young people in nursing homes, right? But you have the conversation and people never say, oh, I really love being in a situation where I don't get to control who I live with or what I eat or what I watch on the TV or any of that kind of stuff. They say, I've always been here. If I'm not here, I don't know how I will live. I don't know how I will have friends and engage with anybody. I fear that I will be lonely. And so what government then gets to go is turn around and say, well, look, that person in that institution, what's living there? And disengage from the conversation where actually what you need is an in-depth, multidisciplinary, trauma-informed approach to supporting that person to understand the actual choices that are available to them and the different ways in which they can achieve those goals. And it may well be that some people, and this has happened in WA, some people decide that they want to get out of the institution, but they've been with three people in that institution for 20 years and they'd like to build a house together, you know, like, and kind of live together, like, you know, or buy a house and do like a regular goddamn house sharing arrangement. Like that.
And they're not sharing bedrooms. They've got their own. They're living within a communal environment, but they still got their own space and being independent.
They can lock their own door. And so we can do that deinstitutionalizing work, again, within a decade is perfectly possible. While at the same time, through what we're doing in education and work, we're actually closing off the pipe. We're preventing people from entering that cycle of segregation. Because there very much is like you want to stop people going into that cycle and then you've got to support people currently trapped within it. And that's, you know, it's complex work, but it needs to be done.
And talking about complex and a lot of grey areas, and it's covered extensively, like in the report and out of it, when you're looking at the criminal justice system. And like there's so much, education is a big one for me, and that's whether it's the people working within those systems and even down to the inmates. Like, you know, the amount of people that get targeted when they're walking through the yard And even, you know, and then when they're trying to transition out of prison, and there's like, we could, that's a whole podcast within itself, but yeah, give us your thoughts on that.
Look, I think there's again, we need to start this conversation with a shared understanding, right? The shared understanding is this. The vast majority of people who are within the criminal justice system, within the prison setting, they are passing through that setting. You know, like it is a moment in their life. They will not stay within that setting for the entirety of their life. And so once we understand that this is a person passing through setting, rather than this kind of mythical idea of like somebody that, I don't know, stays there forever, you know, like they'll be there for their life or whatever, we then can connect with the fact that, okay, well, once that person is within that setting, what is the goal of them being there, and what do we need to provide in order to achieve the outcomes that we want once they've exited, right? Because the vast majority of people will exit, but also a certain number of people will repeatedly re-enter.
See, recidivism.
You know, it's not what we want to see, right? So in that context, we need to acknowledge what's the reality of the people that are passing through this system? And if we start with young people, the vast majority of people in young people in youth correctional facilities are disabled kids.
Huge. There's ASD and intellectual disabilities throughout, everywhere, heaps of mob. Doesn't matter if they're black, white, or brindle.
And you know, like just basic, you think about, because I've visited a couple of prisons, how much of prison compliance, so just you're in there, you know, you're in there, you're trying to navigate the rules of being in there. How much of it comes down to when somebody tells you something, you comply or you are punished, right? And yet just in that small window into the, you've got, you have to be able to hear what you're being asked. You have to be able to interpret what you're being asked to do. You have to then be able to interpret based on what you've been asked, what you're meant to do. And each part of that, if you have a hearing loss, you may miss that. If you have a visual loss, you may miss that. If you have an auditory processing disorder, that may not make sense. If you are autistic, that may not make sense. If you have ADHD, you may well hear it or not remember it, or therefore hearing it and remembering it doesn't stop you necessarily.
Yeah, it's, you know, like, oh, they're just playing up. Let's just lock them back up. Easy done.
So step number one is keeping as many people out of those things as possible, right? Justice reinvestment, reallocation of resources. We've got to stop building prisons, man. We've got to stop building prisons. We've got to take that money and invest it into diversion and dealing with the root causes of the kind of things that land people in those settings. So that's number one. Number two is what for the people that are in, there needs to be proper supports provided. They need to be given proper assessments for all of these basic bloody things and provided with the basic adjustments that are needed, and the prison system needs to adapt to that. So those are the two things that I think we can most do from this report. But ultimately, prison's not a good place for disabled people. We need to be as many people out of those settings.
And talking about prisons, what looked like a prison when watching that Four Corners the other week and seeing these autistic kids that, you know, kids on the spectrum and some with intellectual disabilities, and you got people that are geared up, like five of them on one kid, restrictive practices through the roof. What's going on? God.
Oh, man. Well, look, the baseline of what's going on is that autistic kids are not considered to be fully human, right? Like that's the root cause of ableism generally, right? Whether it's you or me, whether it's autistic kid, like where does it really begin? Where does ableism begin? It begins with the idea that disabled people are really lesser of a human being because of our impairment or difference. Once you depart from the idea that somebody is a lesser form of human being, you can treat them in ways that you would never treat somebody to be a former, like like a full human. And that's exactly what we see there. We see somebody being treated in a subhuman way. And we sterilize that and we sanitize that even through language like restrictive practices or assertive, what do they call it? Assertive something behavior and all that kind of thing. And it's really just a rebranding of abuse. It's huge. It's violent. It's assault is what it is. We watched on national television as a child was assaulted by adults in a context that made that, you know, seem okay to the people that were involved. And I think we need to have a really, really, really assertive discussion about the reality that a therapy, if it is not human rights aligned, is not a therapy. It's an abuse. And it's not acceptable. You know, you should not be able to do this upon a child or an adult and simply call it therapy and that's fine. And that's physical or emotional abuse. And people say, oh, well, forms of these practices that don't involve those kind of physical interventions, they're simply to do with rewarding the right behavior. Well, so what? Like, that's not rewarding the right behavior, that kind of behavior change stuff. It must be within human rights.
You're not going to be able to beat the autism out of them. It's not going to happen.
And why, like, both of us as fellas that can't, well, unless you've had a breakthrough since I last saw you, right? People that can't, you know, walk flight of steps, right? So if somebody said to either of us, no, I'm not abusing you, Jordan. I'm just going to give you a chocolate when you take a step, you know, because we want to reward the right behavior. Ignore the fact that, you know, I've got CP and it means my brain works different.
Somehow certain nerves are going to come back and they're going to be like, we just want the chocolate, thanks.
We'll just give you a chocolate and you take a step because then you walk and that's way more convenient for us and you'll be able to perform all the social functions of walking, which is much more convenient for us, affirming for us, than modifying our expectations to meet your access. We would say that's cooked.
Proper cooked.
We would say that's absolutely and yet that's what, unfortunately, many of these practices amount to, even in their sanitized form, is a form of emotional reward and therefore emotional denial when a neurodivergent person or child is a typical form of social interaction or behavior, and that's not okay.
Last question, Jordan. So we're going to have to revisit back on the Royal Commission. This is, you know, in time ahead. We've got to see how it rolls out and see if it takes effect. It will, especially when you've got people like yourself and others that are going to lead the charge. Righto. But my last question is just your thoughts on digital platforms for supports and just the way these are governed and when you got faceless people behind it. I just want to know your thoughts about it. You know, when you've got the people that are hired through these things and the supports that are given and some of the training and lack of.
Yeah. Be careful here, Jake. I think what we want is a system of supports where somebody can get a good support worker, a good, a good bit of help. To be able to get it in a way that the disabled person gets what they need and the worker gets what they need, you know, so you get good support, the person gets good pay and support, and it meets both persons' needs. And that's a very legitimate aspiration that we have to stretch to. And I think that sometimes we can kind of say, well, the problems we're seeing here is because the interaction's facilitated digitally or through an app or whatever. So if it wasn't, or if there was, you know, there's a conversation about, you know, more people registered and that kind of thing, that would be, there'd be less of that. And my personal experience of the system and disabled people that I work with is that whether it's an app-facilitated service provider or a non-app-facilitated service provider, if the culture's not right, people still have shit experiences.
It's just a lack of management behind it. So something happens and then there's no, you know, when it's line management and then it trickles up the system, that's what I get scared of. Right.
Yeah. No, I agree. But also, I would say, like, look at some of the people whose failures kicked off the Royal Commission in the first place. Urala, biggest provider in disability in Victoria, very traditional provider. In WA's, largest, most institutionalized providers with management line item folks out of the bloody wazoo, and they still are not only referred to the Royal and failure, but also are continually pinged by the Quality and Safeguard Commission. So if you've got app-based doing the bad stuff and you've got traditional providers doing the bad stuff, to me that says that actually the determining factor here isn't the method through which the service is provided. It's actually the way in which the disabled person is empowered or disempowered in that dynamic. And that ultimately leads me back to my kind of real passion in the support space, which is peer support. It is disabled people employing other disabled people to provide them with the support services they need. And that's ultimately what we've got to grow as fast as we can, because there's no reason why me and you couldn't go shopping together, where one of us wouldn't be able to go on our own. A friend of mine in regional WA employs they've got a multiple sclerosis, and they employ they're autistic, they use a manual chair, and they employ a bloke with Down syndrome to help them their shopping, who's also an autistic. So, you know, like, and that person, they'd never be able to afford to be registered or any of those
things. No.
Perfectly able.
Yeah. And that's all I'm saying. As long as they're done right and it helps a person with disability and they get what they need, whether it's a person that's receiving the services or, like you're saying, it's a person that's given the services that's got disability, and we need to really push that. Senator, I know you're busy and you got to scoot out of here and get those wheels turning. Appreciate your time once again, and look forward to our next convo down the line, hey?
Real pleasure, Jake. Thanks so much. Have a great day. See ya. Bye.
Solid yarn with the Senator. Jordan Steele John in the hot seat from lived experience and projecting what he thinks should go ahead off the back of those 222 recommendations. Really important. And I really want to see the positive nature of what he said, what my thoughts are, what the millions of Australians think should go forward off the back of that document. And we'll keep persevering, regardless if things get over the line or not. We'll keep chipping away. The wheels don't stop turning. Perpetual motion, folks. That's it. Inclusivity, accessibility, leveling the playing field. We'll keep pushing. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe or follow button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to roll with the squad and become a patron, that'd be great. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at StraightRollingCheetah or email one word, StraightRollingCheetah@gmail.com. Via Facebook, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs. So check it out. And also via LinkedIn, Jake Briggs. And I want to thank our sponsors, Permabil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.